I'm Scott Black, and you're listening to Drinking and Droshing, Torah with a Twist. And I am also with a twist.
Hey, Gabe.
Hey, Amanda.
I'm really excited to end this year strong.
Yeah, no, it's been a very busy year, but yeah, I'm feeling pretty good about how the end's shaping up.
Yeah, I mean, and especially we're ending this year and we're kind of coming to the end of the book of Genesis.
Yeah, just two portions left.
Yeah. So what would happen if we decided that we wanted to, I don't know, shake things up on this particular episode?
You mean like a shaken cocktail? Because I planned a stirred one.
Oh, okay. No, I meant like maybe we talk about Torah a little bit, but we actually talk about the thing that we do all the time, which is try to translate that Torah into tangible tactics for people.
Oh, I mean, yeah, that sounds great.
Well, there's a lot that happens in this portion, but there's also a lot of standing around. And let's be real, Joseph's got a plan for the future. There's going to be a famine. There's got to be provisions. There's got to be a plan. And I'm pretty sure our guest is able to help us walk through that.
That sounds awesome. Let's do it.
All right, let's go. Depending on when this episode comes out, either it is the last day of Hanukkah or Hanukkah will have just ended. But don't worry, we're really excited because we still have a gift of a person to come help us with the second to last. That's the penultimate parsha of Bereishit, which is an incredible, incredible, exciting episode, if you will, for Vayigash. What are we going to meet this time? Well, we're not sure. But we have somebody who might be able to help us as we're planning for the future and the end of this particular book. So today, it is a pleasure, it is a privilege, it is a joy, and not so much a job to introduce my friend Scott Black as our featured guest. Scott grew up in Columbia, Maryland, which is a suburb of Baltimore. He went to college at University of Maryland, Baltimore County for graphic design. Soon after graduating, he left his graphic design position for a role in IT. A few years later, his summer camp called and asked if he'd like to come back full-time as assistant director. Just like a good camper, Scott was absolutely in and decided it was definitely an opportunity not to pass up. He accepted? Of course he accepted, excitedly. During this time, Scott married his wife, Lauren, who he met in college during a Hillel dating event. The awes go here, audience. We know that you're excited, especially when there's a meet cute in the Jewish world. A few years later, their daughter was born, but don't worry, he also has a son that came by a few years after that, but that'll come later, just like in our portion. As a new father, Scott was looking for an opportunity where he could be home more often, especially in the summer. Towson University Hillel was looking for an assistant director, and it was a perfect fit. I'm seeing a pattern here, Scott. While at Towson Hillel, Scott created an app called Swipe that was used to help track and report on engagement. Word of Swipe spread quickly and has been implemented at Hillels and federations throughout North America. With Swipe taking off and Scott looking for his next steps, Hillel International hired him as, wait, you guessed it, assistant director for digital solutions. Recently, Scott received a call from his summer camp asking him to return as director of operations. An opportunity to come back and serve his camp family and home family at the same time was perfect. And we're so excited that they have you, and we're so excited that we have you. So, Scott, welcome to Drinking and Droshing, Torah with a Twist. Welcome to the show, my friend. I'm so stoked to spend this time with you.
Thank you. I'm so excited to be here.
Of course, and it wouldn't be a fun episode if I didn't get to introduce one old friend to another amazing friend. And so, Gabe Snyder, co-host with the Comos, get excited because you have a comedy genius on this particular episode with Scott Black. He might come with some challenges and some questions. Are you feeling up to it?
Can't wait. Let's go.
Amazing. Okay, well, I guess we'll get started.
So you might remember that last week, Joseph did that sneaky thing where he put his royal cup in Benjamin's bag when nobody was looking and then stopped the brothers as they were about to leave and said, "Stop, you robbers, your little number's up. One of you has stolen my precious golden cup." It was actually silver, but don't worry about it. Andrew Lloyd Webber certainly didn't. Now, Joseph started searching through the brothers' bags. Everyone was nervous. No one could relax. Evidently, it was in Benjamin's bag, much to everyone except Joseph's surprise. But Judah offers himself up in Benjamin's place as Joseph's servant to spare Jacob losing his second favorite son. Joseph was so moved by Judah's selfless offer that he sent everyone out of the room, cried really loud, and then revealed himself to his brothers. "Can't you recognize my face? Is it hard to see that Joseph, whom you thought was dead, your brother, is me?" Andrew Lloyd Webber's questionable syntax aside, the brothers, shocked and probably at least a little bit terrified, were unable to speak. Joseph tells the brothers not to worry about selling him into slavery because it was clearly God's plan all along. After all, if Joseph were never sold into slavery, then nobody would have predicted the famine and all of them would have starved. So really, they did everyone a favor, I guess. So Joseph sends them back to Canaan to bring Jacob to Egypt. They all have a tearful reunion scene with hugs and kisses. Cute. When Pharaoh heard that Joseph's brothers were in town, he told Joseph to get all the rest of the family to Egypt so Pharaoh can give them all sorts of nice stuff. So the brothers head off on their journey with new wagons courtesy of Pharaoh and new food and new clothing. Joseph also gives Benjamin a special gift of 300 pieces of silver and 5 new outfits. Fancy. Joseph also sent 10 donkeys with grain, bread, and food to his father. When they told Jacob that Joseph was alive, his heart froze, but don't worry, he came alive again after hearing about Joseph's position and saw all the stuff he sent. So Jacob and company make their way down to Egypt, making a quick pit stop in Beersheba for a sacrifice. God calls out to Jacob, and Jacob answers, "Hineni, here I am." And God tells Jacob not to be afraid. God will go down with Jacob and bring him back up again. We get a very long genealogy, no time for that, but suffice to say, there's a lot of people going down to Egypt. Judah leads the way to Joseph, announcing the arrival of all of these people. Joseph runs to greet Jacob and throws himself onto his father's neck, weeping. Jacob is also very happy. Oh, by the way, Egyptians don't like shepherds? Interesting. Anyway, Joseph tells Pharaoh that the family has arrived. Pharaoh gives them the best land and gives them jobs as keepers of Pharaoh's own livestock. Pharaoh also meets Jacob, which is nice. Reminder, there's still a famine going on, but don't worry because Joseph prepared Egypt to wait it out. That said, Joseph was kind of shady about doling out the rations. He sold it to the Egyptians for silver, and when they ran out of silver, for their livestock, and when they ran out of livestock, for their land, and ultimately their labor as slaves. Weirdly enough, though, they don't seem to mind very much. So yeah, Israel is in Egypt and everything is okay. I'm sure it will stay that way for a long time. And that's Parashat Vayigash. How'd I do, Scott?
Gabe, that was absolutely beautiful. I love your humor in that. And I have no challenges, because how can one challenge such a being as yourself? Although I do want to go a little bit more into the color of the cup. We think it's silver, not gold.
Yeah, that's correct. It's definitely a silver cup.
You know what, Gabe? You're right. And you know how I know you're right? Because I put that question into an AI bot, and it told me definitively that the cup was silver. Although it may have been painted, it was definitely silver.
I mean, I'm glad the AI bot knows the answer, but also you can look at the text because we have that.
Yeah, text is great, but the AI bot is all over. It is all information into one place.
Gabe, just like God is here and God is there and God is supposed to be everywhere, so too the AI bot.
I don't know. I'm pretty sure Safaria is also everywhere.
This conversation took a weird turn.
Scott, I'm really thrilled that you're here. And I have to tell you, I have spent a lot of time with you dealing with, I would say, community in some sort of chaos. That we were dealing a lot of the time in the work that we did together, or even past the work that we did together, with a lot of people that had plans, but maybe not the right type of organization, or they had dreams, but maybe not the right tools, or they had people in place, but maybe not the right tactics. And this portion deals a lot with all of those. There's a lot of planning and scheming and trying to figure out what comes next. And you have been dealing with this, it seems like, in every job that I listed in your bio in some way or another. And so what was it that drew you to being a problem solver, to being a person who was able to say, like, look, I can get us from idea to implementation and I can get some calm into this chaos, but we're going to have some fun while we go about it.
Yeah. And the fun is the important part, right? If you look at my resume, all those jobs were fun, with exception to the IT work, which is pretty, you know, mundane, but I always had fun with it. But to answer your question, you should make plans for everything, and you should expect those plans to not work out, right? We would joke, creating programs at camp, you know, the question is always like, okay, what's the rain plan? And our joke answer is, oh, it's not going to rain. And so you should always have a rain plan, and you hope that you don't need to use it. But then you should also expect that your rain plan is not going to work. And that's okay, as long as you are able to punt and to go with the flow. And to me, all the plans in the world are fantastic. But if you don't have the right people surrounding you, then it doesn't matter. Anytime we had to deal with any sort of issue, it was all about the people that we surround ourselves with that helped us get through it. Whether, you know, it's students, whether it's staff, whether it's campers, whatever it is, whether it's the customer support person that I had to call because as an IT person, I didn't know the answer, right? It's still someone that I'm surrounding myself around because that person paid for the upgraded support.
How do you, as somebody in a leadership position, make sure that you have those people around you? How do you, A, know who you're gonna need in the future? How do you know what expertise you're gonna need? But also, how do you, I guess, qualify who the best person for the job is? How do you form a team?
Yeah, there's not one right answer to that. But to me, it's finding the people that can think on their feet. And I do that a lot. If I'm hiring people, I do that a lot within the interview process. I don't like to ask normal interview questions. I don't like to ask, what are your three weaknesses? What are your three strengths? I like to ask questions that people aren't going to expect. I remember when I was working at Towson Hill and we were hiring an engagement coordinator, I asked her questions like, What are you watching on Netflix right now? What's your favorite thing to binge? It's not something that she was expecting within the interview, but she was able to just go and spit off the answer. And we were able to have a good conversation. We were able to riff off of that. On the spot, I had her create a program for me for Rosh Hashanah, and she was able to do it. And that's how I knew that this was the right person for that job. And that's the type of thing that I personally look for in creating a team, someone that can improvise, someone that can just pivot and go and can expect the unexpected.
So I think that those are really important things. And one of the things I want to talk about is camp as what I think people think of as like a really safe space. And I think camps are a safe space often to explore. And I know people are walking away from safe space and they're calling them brave spaces. So let's say the camp is a brave space to kind of explore and push boundaries and figure out who we are. But I want to also bring up this idea of kind of working through emotional issues as a leader. Now, I'm going to say I really appreciate something about this portion that I think is great and also funny at the same time, which is Joseph in the middle of this portion, like, gets very emotional and basically sends all of his team, all of these people that Gabe just said that you should bring around you, like, you know, to, like, hype you up. And he's like, all right, everybody get out, because he, like, thinks he's about to have a meltdown. And then everybody gets out but his brothers. And then he has a huge meltdown where it literally says that he cried so hard and so loudly that everybody could hear, including the people he had sent out of the room. And I want to know what you think about being able to kind of handle the leadership piece while also handling the personal piece, right? Being who you are in difficult moments while realizing that you also have to shoulder kind of the reputation and the expectation of being a leader in the place that you are.
Yeah. And that is the hard part about working at camp, where you have your camp family and they are almost as close to you as your home family.
especially with my summer camp, you know, a huge return rate. Yeah, I grew up there as a camper, as a kid. I was asked to be assistant director years ago, which was a dream. You know, I'm now director of operations. It's a crazy family that we have here, and it's hard for those two things to be mutually exclusive in our camp setting. We had a extremely emotional summer. A lot of stuff happening, and I believe it was the third day of actual camp when the kids were there, we had a massive fire and our dining hall burnt down. We were extremely lucky that no one was hurt and that we were able to continue camp. We didn't have to close down camp. It was amazing that within 24 hours, we had a mobile kitchen and a tent arriving at camp and being able to set up. The very next day after this building, our camp is 100 years old. This building was one of the original buildings on the land. So it was more than 100 years old. It was the mainstay of the camp. So everyone who went through it knew this building and had emotional ties to this building. This building is gone. It was reduced to rubble in this fire. The very next day, we still had our huge carnival where our sister camp came over and we had our carnival and we were able to move on as if nothing had happened. Not because emotionally we were still feeling it, but we knew that we had to keep going. This is summer camp after all. It's for the kids. And I do remember that evening after the carnival, you know, we had our big fireworks celebration, which is something that we do at the carnival. And it was such an emotional moment right then. It has been the longest 24 hours of my life, right? We were up all night watching the building, making sure that the flames didn't come back up. And I just remember I cried. And, you know, it was very dark, so I don't know if anybody could see me, but I knew other people around me who were also in leadership and full-time staff as well. I knew that they were feeling the same thing and they were also in tears. It's just happy emotions that we're able to continue on with camp after that devastating fire and still be able to literally 24 hours after the fact, we're having a carnival with everyone. It's insane. And we're able to do so because we had the right people around us, because we were able to get through this horrible thing with our support, with our community.
You know, I think that what this is reminding me of is this idea of like home is where your family is. You know, the building isn't necessarily what's important. The building is lovely, but it's about those people that are around you. It's about the spirit, it's about the community. And I can't help but think about Vaigash, where there's finally this reuniting scene between Joseph and his brothers and his father and the multitude of people that come with the brothers. It's such an exciting moment for everybody, where, as Amanda said, Joseph cries really loud. But there's also this really wonderful moment when Joseph and Jacob first see each other again, where it says that Joseph falls on his father's neck, which is the exact same thing that the text says about Jacob's reunion with Esau way back in the day. So there's kind of this full circle narrative for Jacob when he reunites with his brother. He has this emotional moment where they fall on each other's necks. And when he reunites with his son, he has that same physical emotional reaction. So I'm kind of curious about how you think about your community in that. For me, I think the particularly in Jewish organizational spaces and particularly in camp spaces, the line between work and family or work and not work can get a little blurry, shall we say. So I'm curious how you kind of think about that as somebody with a family and somebody who sees the value and the importance in these communities.
So I'm torn a little bit with this feeling because, like you said, and like I said before, when you're dealing with camp, the camp family and home family and the emotions between the two, and they're oftentimes not mutually exclusive. to me as a father, you know, I love seeing my daughter go off to camp and have those memories. I'm also very conscious of the fact that her camp world and home world are far more blurred than it was for me growing up. So I try to allow her to have her camp experience and do that. Meanwhile, I have my son who he's 3 and a half right now. So he's in that stage where when he is at camp, he's, you know, baby running around. So he doesn't have that like going off to camp experience yet.
That does raise an interesting thing because I've worked with rabbis and with clergy who have very different ways of dealing with like rabbi's kids. And for those who aren't Jewish camping people, there is a known quantity at Jewish camp called rabbi's kids. And there are some stereotypes about rabbi's kids that we don't need to get into. There are some feelings about rabbi's kids that we don't need to get into. But knowing those stereotypes and knowing those feelings, having heard the stories, rabbis deal with their kids in very, and other Jewish professionals as well, deal with their kids in very mindful ways, knowing that that is going to be a factor in their lives. And so I've worked with rabbis who very explicitly say, the synagogue is my office. It is my work. I don't have toys in my office. You don't get to run around the temple as if you own the place because this is my workplace. And that's not the same as when you're at home. And then I've seen other rabbis who do the exact opposite and who say, this is your home. This is where I spend the majority of my time. So I want you to feel comfortable here too. And so I can see that tension also going into the camp world of, I do need you to see this as my workplace. I do need you to understand that this isn't just a vacation for me, but also I want you to be comfortable here. I want you to feel that this is your space also. So I totally hear what you're saying.
Yeah, we have many conversations. What you hear me talk about at home needs to stay between you because I'm using names. And if you hear that person's name, you don't know. You cannot repeat anything that I'm saying right now. Funny story that happened this summer. There was one staff member talking to another, some sort of issue that she was having. I don't remember the details with it, whatever. But my daughter heard her like talking about the problem and completely just like unassuming little kid comes up and she goes, have you talked to Scott Black about that? She didn't say, have you talked to my daddy? She didn't like, you know, like she played her part right. Like she was not playing the like, my daddy is Scott, you should go talk to him. She was like, have you talked to Scott Black about that? Maybe he can help. It was just so funny and so cute.
So I am curious because I know that we threw this at you and you were excited and nervous to kind of see how these things tied together. And I know that you love the Jewish world. Torah isn't always the language in which you speak about the Jewish world. And so the challenging question comes, which is when you're looking at this portion, how does it tie into the work that you see yourself doing? And, you know, what's the Torah that you're sharing every day?
Can we touch on the fact that Torah is not my language? Because I do think it has shaped my everything. And I always joke that if, you know, the Scott today went in a time machine and was talking to Scott in college and said that you spent the majority of your professional life in the Jewish nonprofit space, I would laugh at myself. So Torah is absolutely not my language. It's not something that I've ever felt comfortable reading, understanding, whatever. I never felt like that was my level. When I started working for Hillel, I made it very clear that I was not a rabbi. Jewish literacy is not my thing. However, I am all about engagement. I am all about bringing people together, and I can make a program out of anything, and let's do this. I ended up in my Hillel career taking my, for lack of a better word, ignorance and using that as an engagement tool. I formed amazing organic relationships with more conservative and Orthodox students by allowing them to teach me Torah, to teach me, to talk to me about the special meanings of X, Y, and Z for what holiday it is, whatever it is. And that just happened organically, but it was because I allowed myself to be vulnerable to the students and to let them know, this isn't my cup of tea. This is, I did not grow up learning this, but I'm here and I want to engage with you. Let's sit down. And we formed some great relationships.
I think that's a really beautiful thing that you were able to take that vulnerability and turn it into a positive, turn it into an engagement tool. I think sometimes we need to be vulnerable in order to truly and really honestly fulfill our roles and do what needs to be done. I'm kind of two minds with this idea of I don't speak Torah. On the one hand, I think, like, if Torah doesn't do it for you, okay, like, cool. Let's find out what does. If you're into, you know, making latkes and, I don't know, singing songs by the campfire, awesome. Let's do that. If you're an Israeli dance person, cool. At the same time, on the other hand, I really hope that every Jewish person feels ownership of the Torah. We all have a piece of it. We all have a connection to it. And even if it's not something we're totally comfortable with or we're totally conversant in, it's still ours and it's still yours. So I'm curious where you, if you're comfortable sharing, where you find yourself in that space of ownership over Torah, even if it's not something you generally delve into. And as an engagement professional and as an educator, as a youth worker, how do we instill this value of ownership over tradition, even if we're not teaching, line by line?
I think for me, being able to engage with a student, a camper, whatever it is, a person, and to discover what their interests are and to bring that out in them is paramount to anything else. If that interest just so happens to be Torah, great. I'm there for the journey. I'm there to connect you. I'm there to help you along. You know, have you met my friend Amanda? You know, for me personally, I've always gone by the motto of however you choose to do Jew is you. So to me, that doesn't always relate back to ownership over Torah or anything else. It's just more about you and what you believe in and how you want to celebrate. And I think that's where I did well in the Hillel world. And that's also where I think I was roadblocked a bit in the world of Hillel, right? I was able to grow engagement fair amount because all of a sudden the students did not see a rabbi up front. They saw the guy ordering the bacon cheeseburger and they said, oh, I don't need to be this way to be involved. There are many different ways of being Jewish. Engagement to me has always been, how do we lower the barrier? Not in a negative way, but how do we make our events, activities, our what we're doing, our mission more accessible to others? And sometimes it was taking, going back into the Hillel world, if we had what we thought was a cute event that was laser tag with the Jews, if we took out the with the Jews and just said laser tag, all of a sudden, a lot more people, Jewish people and non-Jewish as well, but a lot more people were interested in the event. And it was a crazy sort of light bulb moment of, you don't need to have a cutesy, you know, chutzpah name in there. Like, you can be more accessible. My whole thing was trying to make what we're doing more accessible in the hopes of creating meaningful engagement, organic engagement, and then growing our community.
So I think that makes sense. I mean, look, I'm going to throw out the word engagement because it's a buzzword and, you know, No, look, I don't think engagement means what people think it means anymore, right? Like, I think realistically, if we're talking engagement in the way that I've always defined engagement, it's this idea of being able to create opportunities for people to either meet another person, engage in some sort of program, which is a vehicle for, you know, meeting other people, or having the opportunity to explore something different. And really, when I hear you talk about engagement, Scott, I think I hear you talking about relationships, that you are trying to genuinely, accurately, meaningfully, authentically create relationships. And I think that that's powerful no matter what you say. And I think that actually comes in this portion as well, right? Like, there is a piece of this portion that's a lot of dealing with who's in and who's out and who's in power and who's not, and who's the leader and who's not, and who's representing and who's not, and who's stepping up and who's stepping back. And that's all we see in the Jewish community. There are all sorts of people who can be seeing themselves in this portion. You know, the people who have had it easy, the people who are dealing with trauma-based action, the people who are always the victim, right? The people who are always having the goblet that's put into their bag. They didn't do it. It happened to them. You know, and these things, all of these opportunities to meet people where they're at are really meaningful and important, whether it's on a college campus, or whether it's on a general campground, or whether it's in the IT world. These things matter, whether they're in person, whether they're digital. These things matter. And that's what I hear you saying, Scott. I hear you talking about relationships and the importance of building those relationships, not from the ground up, but from the heart out. You know, really bring yourself into it. And I think that's meaningful. And so I want to make sure that people get to hear the real Scott Black. You know, have you asked Scott Black about this? But I'm going to ask Scott Black about this one. Scott, whether or not you speak, you know, Torah is your language. Certainly Jewish community is, and relationship building is. And so my question for you is, in your language, in the Scott Black language, if you had the ability to have one message that you wanted, you know, our listeners to walk away with, or something that you want them to know or feel or do after this episode, what would your message be?
Do I only get one?
You can get two, but I don't know if you're going to run it through, you know, the AGT bot.
So my first message, in regards to those who are trying to build relationships, is to actually talk to and listen to the people you are trying to build these relationships with. That goes back to design thinking methodology and doing discovery interviews and all that stuff, right? If you are not doing what the people you're trying to build relationships with are all about, then you're not going to build those relationships. That's my first thing. My second thing, which I'm not entering into the chatbot, I promise, it would be to try your hardest. I feel like I'm beating a dead horse here, but be accessible. And that means so many different things to so many different people. But in my mind, when I'm saying be accessible, it's try to broaden your spectrum to engage people regardless of their background. You will do amazing things when you take that barrier away and just start building relationships, period.
Hey, Gabe.
Hey, Amanda.
You know how I got you that Hanukkah present where I got you kind of a bartender's tool set and like this cards of bartending, like, you know, drink recipe cards for Hanukkah?
Yeah, I love it. Thank you so much.
Yeah, no, I'm thrilled you love it. And I know that you've been making a lot of drinks with them. And I needed to tell you, I've been missing one of my glasses.
One of your glasses is missing?
Yeah, it's not on the bar cart. You know, I was looking the other day and it's just not there. And I was curious if maybe this week you might have been able to find it.
Well, did you check the dishwasher?
I checked the dishwasher. It wasn't there.
You checked your bags?
Well, I checked my bags, but have you checked your bags?
Oh, no. Could it be? Ha ha ha. That's a joke about this week's Torah portion. This week on Midrashic Mixology, we are proud to present Joseph's Royal Cup. Start with a mixing glass into which we're going to pour in an ounce of rye whiskey because Joseph still has all of that grain. Next, 1 ounce of Campari for being caught red-handed. A 1/4 ounce of vermouth will finish you out. Wait, no! Surprise! Add in 3/4 of an ounce of coffee liqueur for the brother's rather rude awakening and stir with ice until fully chilled. Nice surprise. Strain into a coupe glass or really just the fanciest cup you own. Garnish with an orange twist. Now, for those of you who are thinking that I can't possibly make a non-alcoholic version of this drink because literally every ingredient is alcoholic, you're not wrong. So, if you're a fancy Nespresso owner, make yourself a latte. If you're not, make yourself a cup of coffee with milk. Bonus points if you heat up the milk first. For some royal decadence, add in your favorite chocolate syrup to taste and serve with a chocolate orange for that citrus surprise. Either way, maybe don't frame your brother for theft, or me, raise up your royal cup, L'chaim.
Oh man, that was beautiful, and I think I'm drunk just listening to you.
There was a lot of liquor in that drink. I think I didn't realize how much liquor was in it until it was finished.
I'm going to make it, but I'm going to have to go to at least 3 different liquor stores to get what I need.
Okay, wait, I have a question, and I know that normally don't jump in on this section, but I have to. Okay, Scott, we've been doing these drinks for a really long time, and people are making them at home every week, and we're really excited about that. But question, if we were trying to track data for people who are engaging with our show, for people who might be making these drinks, for people that might want to come to like a live event, hey, we're open for hire. If you want to bring us out to you, we'd be happy to go there. How could we do that? Do you have any tools for us that might make these Midrashic Mixology deals even sweeter?
Amanda, that was the worst segue I've ever heard, but I will take you up on that offer. I think you're referring to Schwipe, and that is the app that I built to help build communities. Basically, we just needed an easy way to be able to collect data and then report on it on our, I'm going to use that, evil word of engagement, but, you know, just because it's so ingrained in my Schwipe world. At the time, we were dealing with college students and we needed an easy organic way to collect the data because without the data, you can't report back to it. You can't go back to your stakeholders and say, look at this amazing job that I'm doing. We need more money to continue doing this amazing stuff. When we started using it, I raised our numbers by over 300%, which, you know, is just my way of saying it was a necessary tool. We weren't doing anything different. We were just actually able to collect our engagement data and then report on it. When I started telling my friends about it, they all said, oh, I need Schwipe. And I turned it into a business. And, you know, it's still active today. Look, I can talk about Schwipe and engagement and tracking and reporting and stakeholders all day, but the truth of it comes down to if you think you're doing a good job collecting data and reporting on it, you're probably not. If you know you're doing a great job, then you are. I love problem solving and I love being a thought partner with people. And that's how I really grew Schwipe, because it wasn't just an app that I put together and threw out there. I have journeys with each and every single one of my users, and I help them succeed and build this stuff.
You know, it does occur to me that last week we had the owner of Schmaltz Brewing Company, which is S-H-M-A-L-T-Z, but Schwipe, I understand, has a C in there.
Yes, very controversial C. S-C-H-W-I-P-E.
All right. Well, I guess we're all going to have to check it out.
All right. As much as I love talking about Schwipe, love talking about coffee drinks that I won't drink because I don't like coffee, and love actually talking with you, Scott, that's not a sarcastic remark. That is a real statement. I do actually love spending time with you. I am unfortunately just responsible for saying we're at our last section. Yikes. So we're at our thank yous and closing cues. So Scott and Gabe, invite you guys. We need to start planning for the future. And let's face it, the future's coming at us soon. 2023 is just around the corner. If we know that there might be troubling times ahead, what's the best first thing that we can do? And Scott, I've been told that it's not panic.
No, it is not panic. My advice is to look at the people around you and see what role you need to play in that moment. Are you the leader telling people to get to X, Y, and Z positions? Or are you the one to run out and order 100 flyers for something for no apparent reason?
Great. So being able to kind of identify where you're standing and what role you might be able to play is really important to moving forward, especially even in this portion too, we learn about that. You know, Judah stepping up to say, hey, take me, let it be me, is a big, beautiful, wonderful moment that I don't think would have been expected way back when the Joseph story started. Gabe, my calm in the storm when I'm dealing with troubling times ahead, what is your suggestion for the best first thing that you can do if you're trying to just plan it out?
I mean, I think you kind of just touched on it, but I'm going back to like way back in the beginning of our conversation with Scott, which, you know, in some ways feels like 5 minutes ago and in some ways feels like 5 hours ago. And here we are. And just say that, like, you need to know who's in your corner. You got to have your team ready. You got to have your people. You got to know who's on your speed dial, who's in the group chat. Yeah, that's probably my first app is make the WhatsApp group.
All right. So knowing who your people are, knowing what your role is, I think for me, and this is like the funny part, is I'm a planner. Gabe knows it. Gabe is not as much of a planner. Idan, I think, is somewhere in between. But for me, like, I like to know what's coming down the pike. And I also realize that if I spend too much time living in the future, that's where my anxiety grows. You know, when I'm not living in the present, but I'm living in the future, that is pure anxiety for me. So while I do like to plan for the future, I also make sure that I'm always grounding myself with where I am today and what that looks like today. And if the things that I'm doing now might be helping me succeed for the future, or, you know, be able to make that change that I want to make in the future. Either way, it gets to be a little stressful sometimes, but rewarding at other times if I realize that the change I want to make isn't going to be done today. You know, they say Rome wasn't built in a day. Well, neither are most of the big changes that we're all planning for the new year, right? That's why resolutions are tricky. But that might be a conversation for a different podcast. After all, we're still ending 2023 with this one. So, Scott, if people want to get into conversation with you, if they want to be able to check out Shwipe, if they want to be able to continue those camp connections, how can they best find or follow you?
Website is shwipe.com. As Gabe said, it's S-C-H-W-I-P-E. And then my email is just scott@shwipe.com.
Amazing, simple, beautiful. And also that website is bomb. It's really, really great. I know I saw it when it was created. Go spend time on it. It's super fun. And also Scott's really good at responding to emails. So if you actually want to continue the conversation, or if you want to engage in meaningful engagement data, if you really want to know who you're connecting with and how, Scott's a really great person to be able to speak with in order to better tell your story. And I think that's really important. So speaking of stories, Scott, any last words, thoughts, concerns, or jokes?
Boy, do I have a joke for you. I can't take credit for this. This is coming straight from the AI bot. The joke is, why was Joseph's silver cup so important to him?
Why?
Because it was his divining rod ent. A play on words, as rodent sounds similar to, wait, what? Rodent? I don't know. I don't get this joke. AI failed. A divining rod is a tool used for divination. This joke plays off the fact that Joseph used his silver cup as a divination tool, as well as the idea that the divining rod is a tool used for divination. The punchline of the joke, because it was his divining rod end, makes a play on words by combining the words rodent and rod and suggests that the cup had some special power or significance to Joseph. Does that make any sense?
This might be the one time where a joke was not funnier when it was explained.
All right, I want to produce a different joke.
All right, no, that's staying in though. Everybody gets to listen to that, man. But he's going to give 1 second one based on the AI bot, so stay tuned. Hold on.
Oh, oh, oh.
Oh, here's another Torah joke. Okay, same. Okay, ready? Why was Joseph's silver cup such a big deal?
Why?
Because it was the only thing his brothers hadn't stolen from him.
Wow.
Is that a joke?
On that note, Scott, thank you so much for being with us this evening and for this episode. It's been a pleasure getting to speak with you and get to really listen to some of the ways that you've made plans and pivoted when things have not necessarily gone so well. We deal with it all the time in the Jewish community. We just tend to not talk about it. And I would actually argue it might be a really good opportunity for us to share best practices when we're dealing with calamities or chaos, to be able to say, like, hey, how did you handle this thing? And be able to learn from each other and with each other. That'd be pretty cool. Thank you to Gabe for creating an awesome rundown that wasn't AI created, but it was Gabe created. And also, by the way, for creating Midrashic Mixology, another drink that I won't drink, but I'm excited for you to have it later. It's going to be a party, and apparently Scott's going to need a designated driver after having one, so hopefully he'll just have it at home. Other than that, thank you to Edan, our executive producer, who couldn't be here tonight, but always make sure that we keep the trains running on time, and to our editors, Mike and Kate, for making sure that these episodes sound so great and beautiful. Scott's going to be excited about that one, I know. He's already said thank you a million times during the recording. To our listeners, we love you. Stay tuned for our conclusion coming at you soon. Gabe, I really appreciated what Scott had to say about this idea of maybe Torah not being our language, but the Jewish people, the Jewish community being our language. I think there are a lot of people that could get on board with that, that are often the people who are saying, hey, I'm not Jewish enough to talk about that, or that's not really where I feel like my comfort level is. But they have so many gifts to be able to give the Jewish community and the people that they engage with every day.
I totally agree. In a kind of ironic way, it actually reminded me of a verse of Torah, Deuteronomy chapter 33, verse 4, which is the fourth verse in the last portion of the Torah in Vizot HaBracha, Torah tziva lanu Moshe, Morasha kihilat Yaakov. When Moses gave us the Torah, when Moses gave us the teaching, the law, it was an inheritance for all of the community of Jacob. And I think there's something really beautiful about the idea that you don't need to center your life around Torah. You don't need to center your life around any one aspect of Judaism in order to be fully and completely and authentically Jewish. And at the same time, I really truly believe that every Jew has a portion of Torah. The Torah belongs to every Jew, whether they study every day or, you know, never became B'nai Mitzvah. I truly believe that to be true. And so I think actually the way that we tie those two things together, the way we harmonize those seemingly disparate ideas, is through projects like this podcast, where we take Torah and we turn it into, as you like to say, tangible tactics. We bring it into modern context, talking to people like Scott, who can relate to the Torah, who can talk about Torah, but talk about it from their own perspective and talk about it in the context of their life and their work.
So I think one of the things that I have always loved is this idea that Scott enters most Jewish environments saying, I'm not a rabbi, but... And I have to tell you, as somebody who's about to be a rabbi, but... I'm not necessarily the rabbi that most people think of when they think about rabbis, right? Like, I'm a person who really, when people say, oh, I'm not Jewish enough for this, hear the opportunity to engage them and go, like, man, like, why is this for you, right? Why is this for me? And so I think when we're able to look at it that way, we enter into those encounters, we enter into those relationships that Scott was trying to lift up before. When we're authentically able to say, like, hey, wait a minute, there's definitely a space for you here, whether it's at a dinner, whether it's at a discussion, whether we're just doing FaceTime, or whether we're in a Zoom call, to be able to say, like, no, your voice matters, especially because you have a different perspective than maybe the rabbi or cantor sitting, you know, across the table from you. Those things get to collaborate and culminate in something really powerful and meaningful and memorable. And that language is something that I think speaks deeply to almost anybody that can hear it.
And I would argue this too is Torah, and we all have things to learn.
I definitely love that fiddler on the roof. You're also right, you know, thing that you just threw at me. But I will say, listen, if you're continuing to listen and end this year strong with us, we've loved having you with us. We always love the ability to have these conversations with people who are bringing their Judaism out into the field and also sometimes bringing the field into their Judaism. And that's important too. We get influenced in everything that we do and with all the people that we're in relationship with. So hear us out. We love being in relationship with you. We hope that you have an incredible new year, and we're looking forward to continuing our track record of bringing you awesome content with awesome people in 2023. For now, stay healthy, stay happy, and only good things to you in 2023. Happy New Year. Happy post-Hanukkah or happy almost end of Hanukkah. We raise our glasses to you and we say, L'chaim.
L'chaim.
I'm Scott Black, and you just listened to Drinking and Droshing, Torah with a Twist. And if you think you know my twist, think again.